Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
But I just took that breath in and I swam down. I found this ledge and I just sat on it. And there was nothing to see. It was so cold. And it was just the best moment. It felt like coming home and just that quiet sound of the water, the stillness, the pressure. And I didn't know, but I basically, on my very first time, just swam down to 20 meters and sat there on a ledge, like contemplating.
Welcome to the Adventure Podcast and this episode with Hanley Prinsloo. Hanley is a South African freediver, speaker, writer and ocean conservationist. She's the founder and executive director of Iron Water, an ocean conservation trust dedicated to conserving and protecting the world's oceans through human experience. In this episode, we talk about her early life growing up on a rural South African farm, how she got into freediving, competition and then why she left the competition circuit. We then go on to talk about motherhood, conservation, and her changing view of the world as a result of her forays underwater. Finally, we talk about why you can probably hold your breath for a lot longer than you think. I also want to very briefly mention we've now launched the Adventure Podcast Plus, where free subscribers get access to a newsletter that features links, insights, and opinions on the world's adventure and exploration. Paid subscribers get access to a whole load of new bonus content, including a monthly Q&A with a guest, access to filmed InVision podcasts, access to our shorter form podcast, The Dispatches, and subscriber-only posts and articles. To get involved, head to theadventurepodcast.substack.com. And finally, before we start, I'll just give a huge shout out to the Martin Moran Foundation, our charitable partner, who help people from disadvantaged backgrounds get outdoors, upskill, and fall in love with mountains. If you're in a position to, please consider donating to the foundation. Okay, over to Hanley Prinsloo. So, thanks very much for doing this. I think, as usual, the logical place to start is the start. So if you could introduce yourself, tell me who you are and what you do, whatever that means to you.
Sure. My name is Hanley Prinsloo, and I'm a freediver. You know, they always leave like one line on occupation, on like visa forms and stuff, and I'm the person who needs three lines for the occupation line. I'm a freediver, an ocean conservationist, and an entrepreneur. And then the most important line, and also a mom. So, yeah, and I live in Cape Town in South Africa.
Amazing. And is that where you're from?
No. You know, Cape Town is one of those places where you occasionally pop into this rare breed of people who are from Cape Town. Most of us are, you know, flown in. I grew up on a horse farm outside Johannesburg in the northeastern South Africa, very far from the closest ocean, but very close to wild spaces and lots of big animals.
I mean, what was that like?
I think especially now that I have my own small kids, I am so aware of what a magical childhood I have, just how grateful I am for that. my dad bred horses in a way that I now realize is the only way to treat animals. You know, now there's been books written and movies made about horse whispering. He just called it good horsemanship. And it's about relationship. And it's about relationship between people and animals. And that was ingrained in me very, very early on. And so the farm was a big wild space. And there were two rules. My sister and I would roam freely. And the rules were come home before the sunset and don't die. And I think those are very, very good rules to give to your small children, because don't die means you have to do your own risk assessments. As a five-year-old, like, if I do this, I'm definitely going to climb to the top of this tree and jump into the dam. Might it kill me? So yeah, I had a wonderful childhood of wilderness and freedom and starting to understand my place in nature.
Yeah, and I think the world's changed so much, hasn't it? Like, you and I have very different upbringings in lots of ways, but as a, you know, British boy, you know, there's not much out there in the natural world, natural with big inverted commas, given where I'm from, that's going to hurt me or kill me. What was, I know it's kind of a really ignorant question, but like the obvious stuff that's going through my head is these little kids running around, you know, on a big, big, big ranch with all of the various like large fauna running around. Is that a thing? Was that a risk or an issue?
I think on the farm I grew up on, the big animals were mostly the horses and some others, but, you know, the occasional, we once saw a baboon, but that's unusual. That's more here in Cape Town. We had jackal, and that was really interesting because they would come very close if you sat quietly, but they wouldn't necessarily take down a child. It was more like we climbed to the top of this hill. These are the kind of rocks the puff adders always sleep on, you know, like which of the snakes are very poisonous. Like, what do they do? Like learning about nature, like, what do the snakes do at different times of the year, different times of the day? During the sun, they'll be lying on the rocks. You know, when it gets colder, they'll be moving down into the stables. So yeah, learning about your environment and learning about where things are dangerous and which things aren't. I mean, giant porcupines, I mean, how exquisite. But they're mostly nocturnal. But then it's like, if the dog goes with us, don't let the dog go into the porcupine hole.
That one's very specific.
Very specific, because if the dog goes into the porcupine hole, you'll have to pull it out by its tail, and it invariably has like porcupine spikes in its poor face. Anyway, we're going very deep down this rabbit hole of the wild things on the farm. But yeah.
It's fascinating though, because I think, you know, for me and maybe lots of people listening, like, it's such an abstract, in a good way, kind of way to grow up. You know, it's not something we hear about very often. And in some ways, it sounds idyllic. I'm sure in other ways, it maybe wasn't, but it's rare, isn't it? I think.
Absolutely. And I think now, having small children myself, if I could transplant the farm I grew up on to be closer to the ocean, I would do it in a heartbeat. I would love to give them that kind of childhood. But it's a different world, right? It's not just geography. I think the whole world has changed. Unless you choose some kind of strange isolation that I don't want to do for them, you can't be separate from humanity and from what has happened in the world since I was a kid.
I think you're right. It's such a, I think about that a lot. Again, we're going into the parenting thing a bit early maybe, but that is what's changed. You know, I think that we used to run feral, even though I'm from a fairly urban area. And our rules were the same, like, see you for dinner, you know, don't get hurt, but you probably will, you know. And are we going to get that with our kids? I don't know. It doesn't feel like that's the sort of thing you do anymore, and you get frowned upon for doing it. But yeah, maybe we owe it to ourselves to make it possible somehow.
Yeah, or even just pockets of it. I think pockets of it are possible, finding those places where you can come back to every year, be it for a week or 2 weeks, where they can taste that.
Yeah, totally. So before we go so deep into the whole parenting thing,
we start planning our family trips right now.
Well, I'm going to do New Zealand, and I really want to do Kenya. That's the before they start school. But let's talk about freediving. I mean, obviously, that's where we're going a bit with this. So how, you know, being from where you're from, how do you become a freediver?
On this farm, we were very lucky to have bodies of water So I often found myself in water as a small as a child, and there was two rivers, a dam, and a swimming pool that turned green every time the lightning struck it, which happened on every summer storm. So these not so blue bodies of water, but I absolutely loved being underwater. I mean, as a child, my sister and I would dream of being mermaids, and we made up this clicking sound where we could talk to each other underwater, and I've always just wanted to be underwater. And when I was 18, I had the opportunity to do a scuba diving course in Mozambique. And I loved the ocean and the coral reef and the fish and everything. But I found the actual scuba diving so disappointing. I couldn't move through the body of water, like through the ocean as I wanted to, through the water column, like up and down. You know, you're restricted to like stay down. You can't go up. You know, it's very equipment heavy. It's not how I imagined my body to be moving in water. So I thought, I guess that was just a childhood dream, right? Like, that's it then. And then I studied in Sweden, of all places, after high school. And I met this Swedish film editor, actually. I was working on a film project. And he said to me in Swedish, "Have you heard about free diving, fridykning?" And I immediately thought, this is completely a translation error. Like, firstly, nothing is free. And secondly, what is that? You know? And he tried to explain it to me. And my mind just went, click. That's what I was looking for, right? And so we went out into the fjord. And I was like, the wetsuit didn't fit properly and the mask was leaking and like the equipment was just a disaster. But I just took that breath in and I swam down. I found this ledge. And I just sat on it and there was nothing to see. It was so cold and it was just the best moment. It felt like coming home, and just that quiet sound of the water, the stillness, the pressure. And I didn't know, but I basically on my very first time just swam down to 20 meters and sat there on a ledge, like contemplating. Yeah. And I came back up and he was completely freaked out. And he was like, "You said you've never done this before." I said, "Well, I haven't done it before, but I've always dreamt of doing it." And that was, I was 19, and that was the start.
That's incredible, though, because I mean, you know, not to sort of go into too many stories from my side, but I really struggle underwater. Like, I've surfed a lot, I swim a lot, I'm confident, but I can't get down and I can't hold my breath that well. And what was it? Is it natural aptitude or just like maybe that deep longing? How do you get down to 20 meters?
I think there is natural aptitude, but I think there's also comfort, just being comfortable in the water. Everybody has the ability to hold their breath longer than they think. Everybody has the ability to go down. Don't tell me about your small lungs. Don't tell me about your childhood ear issues. Like, I've heard it all. None of these things are actual barriers to entry. They all have solutions. It's a matter of finding comfort underwater and then building the knowledge on top of that. And I just had the comfort. And so my body naturally could hold its breath long enough and my ears could equalize. And I just went down there. And I think that for me has always been the foundation of my freediving. It's like finding the comfort and being so relaxed underwater.
Yeah, it's incredible. So, you know, that was the first taste, as it were. You realized this thing existed and the world unlocked. You know, if we were to fast forward your successes, passion, etc., you know, it's a long list. What happened next?
I think like many of us who discover a talent, you think you have to reach its ultimate expression. I think that often happens when you discover a talent. So in freediving, that meant I started competing, because I thought that would be the ultimate expression of being a talented freediver. So I started competing in the pool in Sweden, holding my breath for as long as I can. In freediving, we compete in three categories: depth, distance, and time. So swimming as deep as possible on one breath, or as far as possible underwater on one breath, or holding your breath for as long as possible. And I competed in all three and started breaking records right off the bat. And there is, I think, some pleasure to be found in being the best at something and actually breaking records. Freediving being such a small sport at the time. I mean, it's still not a very large sport, but back then it was like, you know, nobody even knew how to spell it. And it was just really fascinating in the competition arena to get to know my body. So it went from the enjoyment of, gosh, I'm really good at this, I'm breaking records, to the records don't matter, what can my body do? And that is super fascinating. You know, when you come up against something you think is a barrier, like, I don't think I can go deeper than 30 meters. Like, that's maybe as deep as I can go, or 35. And then you tweak this, you work on that, you train differently, you eat differently, you do a different style of yoga and lung expansion, and suddenly it opens up and you go to 40, 45. And then again, okay, now this is feeling hard. What do I have to tweak? And I think that's just the journey of self-discovery that I think is the greatest gift freediving can give to any person.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting kind of conversation point, because maybe in parallels with like ultra running or something, we're not just talking about physical prowess, are we? We're talking maybe even 80% head game or beyond. You know, what does it take to be a good freediver in that sense? And what has it given you outside of being underwater?
I think that's 100% what you're saying. I think freediving can initially feel very much like a physical sport because it's physically very other. You are underwater, you are moving in three dimensions, you are holding your breath. It's so different to what we know on land, right? You can be a road runner, a trail runner, a hiker, a walker, you're kind of upright moving forwards with gravity. But freediving, like, everything is off the table. It's so different. And so it can initially be experienced as an extremely physical experience. And then once you kind of tame the physical and the physical feels easy, it becomes 100% mental. So the very first moment somebody feels like, oh, this is hard now, it's mental. And for some people, that's 5 meters. For some people, that's 10 meters. For some people, that's 60 meters. Oh, Matt just points at himself. It's 5 meters. You see, so it happens for people at different times. And I think that's kind of the beauty of it, because people come into freediving thinking, this is going to be so easy for me. I'm such a water person. I'm a big wave surfer. I'm a this, I'm a that, you know, whatever. And freediving just humbles the crap out of you. It's like, nope, you thought this about yourself. Nope. Again. And I think that's really healthy in a way. And for me personally, I went through many, many, many of those experiences of I can't go deep, I can't go longer, I can't go further. And then coming back to, it's not about the physical, it's about the mental, it's about the emotional. And then once you really dig deeper, it becomes around even the spiritual. And
sure.
I've learned possibly more about myself than I actually would have wanted to know. But the light, you know, when we shine light on places of ourselves we haven't seen and didn't think we'd see, you know, I think we grow.
Yeah, I mean, you just started to there. I'm going to ask you to do it. Like, what do you mean by that? You know, you've seen more of yourself than you maybe wanted to.
You start, you know, I think when you're holding your breath underwater and going for something, you're so on the edge of what's possible and what's not possible, and listening to yourself, not listening to yourself, pushing further than you should or not. You know, I think I've come face to face with my own ego in ways that I would have preferred to not admit that it exists. I have been afraid of things that in retrospect is quite embarrassing. Like, that wasn't real. That was all in my mind, you know? So it's like there's real experiences. And in the moment when you're underwater and you're completely alone, you know, a couple of minutes can feel like a very, very long time because those experiences are extremely deep, for lack of a better word, but very, very pivotal. So, yeah, I think that's kind of what also people say, you know, that freediving starts to feel addictive, and it's hard to unpack that. You know, it's not, you know, the action of being underwater or holding your breath. It's also the journey of getting to know yourself that I think is very special.
Yeah. I mean, as I've alluded to, like I'm terrible underwater, and, you know, I'd love to turn this into, hang on, tell me what I'm doing wrong. Cause I get panicky. And I hate that about myself. I'm not a panicky person, but I get panicky. But, I think the only parallel I can really draw is like this long distance running thing of, I find some people go running outside of fitness. Some people go running to get out of their heads.
Right.
Some people go running to get into their heads.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm the latter. It sounds like freediving is probably similar. Some people are there to completely switch off in the moment. It's meditative. Is that what you're looking for? Because it seems like you're getting the opposite.
Yeah, I think when the dive worked for me, then it was the meditative state of quiet. When it wasn't an easy dive, or it wasn't working, or I was pushing through something, it would be the opposite. So you'd experience both, but, and it's both part of the journey and part of the learning, but the state you're aiming for is one of complete relaxation and complete meditation and very, very, very little conscious thought. And the conscious thought that is there is around necessity, equalize, kick, equalize, kick. So really slowing down the thoughts to necessity, because you also don't want to zone out so much that you forget to equalize and bust your eardrum or go longer or deeper than what is safe, you know. So you're an interesting mix of super relaxed and hyper-focused.
Yeah. And my cliche question of the day, there's always one, is, you know, is it inherently dangerous as an activity?
I think freediving, when practiced as it should be, is probably one of the safest things you can do. When not practiced the right way, it can absolutely kill you, and does. And not the right way means not listening to your limits, not diving with a buddy, not being humble and responsible, trust, like not respecting the ocean. Because it's not just about you. If you're in the ocean, it's about the ocean as well, because she's a wild one. So, you know, you have to kind of like also understand who you are in the storyline. And I think when done properly, it is safe. But, you know, I think people have learned more about freediving lately because of the tragedies than because of the triumphs, right? And the greatest female freediver of all time, Natalia Molchanova, died. You know, like she was stronger than all of us. And, you know, the deepest breath, that film on Netflix is about somebody not surviving. And so, you know, I think freediving becomes famous when we look at the moments where something goes wrong. But there's thousands of us diving, making the right choices every day, surviving. And both those individuals I mentioned were extremely experienced. It was one moment of making the wrong decision. And that happens, right? It can happen when you're doing any sport. The stakes are just higher in freediving. So you just have to be very clear on what decisions you make and when and why. Because, you know, if you're trail running and you take the wrong trail, it might be a really long day, but it probably won't kill you.
Yeah. I mean, it's like lots of adventure sports, isn't it? And it's interesting you mentioned the Netflix parallels, because, you know, I work in kind of really authentic brand film, and I also work in TV where, you know, jeopardy is king. And we're dining out on the potential for things to go wrong, because that's what audiences like. It makes it attractive. But yeah, I think what you're saying is totally true. You know, with rock climbing, it's like there are 80-year-old rock climbers out there still getting it done, and they've never had a bad accident because they follow their processes, they listen to their bodies, they understand its head game. Lots of the greatest free soloists, I mean, I think there's only one left alive. That's probably fake news, but lots of the greatest free soloists of all time have all died, you know, in the mountains. But interestingly, this is a tangent, but not necessarily free soloing. I think it can breed complacency.
Exactly. None of these deaths in freediving, one, happened in a competition. And that we're talking like 40 years ago when the equipment was, well, 40, 20 years ago, when the equipment was really not what it is today. And she was doing a discipline called No Limits, where you go down with a weighted sled and up with an air balloon, like in The Big Blue. And it was ego, not hers, but her coaches, who said, today is the day for the dive. The media's here. Everyone's here. This is the record day. Do the dive. And on the way up, her equipment got tangled, as it would when there's 5 meter swell, like, you know. And another, an American freediver, died in competition, Igor. He'd been squeezing his lungs for weeks and weeks and weeks. And I wish the judges or the coach or somebody had said, you're not allowed to dive again. But he dived and he had a blackout and they couldn't bring him back, you know. So there's a series of events that would lead to a tragedy. But in the film, the Netflix film, and even Natalia, those were completely outside of competition accidents. Freak just didn't make the right decision. Because I think it's also when people's guard is down, right? Like, you're a 100-meter diver, it's only a 30-meter dive. You know, your guard is down, you don't follow the protocol. But that's what will kill you, not following the protocol when you are in literally the easiest possible situation is what can kill you.
Totally, yeah. I mean, it sounds like, because I know very little about freediving, and, you know, this conversation, I've not really spoken to a freediver, I don't think, before on the podcast. I've spoken to a lot of climbers, and I know a lot about climbing, but it's fascinating for me because it actually sounds like there are sports within the sport. You know, that experience you described of that calming, meditative, beautiful moment going 20 meters down in Sweden to sit on a ledge is radically different from risking blackout and that feeling of like pressure, am I still conscious? Like, those seem like two completely different sports, games, you know.
Yeah. And I think that's also, for me, something that I'm passionate about today is to really have conversations with beginner freedivers, which has now become so much bigger, like how many people do introductory freediving courses and stuff, and really have a conversation around a journey as a freediver and a good freediver that doesn't have to include competitive freediving, like how you can be a really good, really experienced recreational freediver and really get to know your body and maybe even dive on a rope for depth, but not needing to do it in competition. I think the sport has evolved hugely in the last 10 years and not everything I've seen in that evolution I like. And then there's some parts of it that's really beautiful still, smaller competitions that really celebrates every diver and that gives an opportunity for someone to have goals. Because I also understand that it's something, you know, some people, many people need a goal to be motivated. And if freediving can bring that into your life and be the thing that you love so much that you actually want to do so much of it that you get good at it and it motivates you and gives you a goal, then that's wonderful and good for your general well-being, right? And that means it never has to bring you to anything dangerous, and it probably won't bring you to a national or a global record, but you can still break your own personal best and feel a sense of achievement and grow your self-esteem and grow your community. And I think that's something that certain types of competitions can do, and that I'm looking forward to being a part of in some way, but really intensely deep competitions just for depth and record attempts has lost the luster for me a little bit.
Yeah, no, I get that completely. And of course, that's the stuff that makes the mainstream press and the headlines and the movies, in the same way that, you know, you mention a mountain, ask people to pick a mountain, they probably say Everest, right? It's like, I couldn't be any less interested. You know, there are more unclimbed mountains in the world than there are climbed mountains. And there are people who are getting stuff done every year in places no one's ever heard of, you know, in the Western world. And that, you know, it's a nice segue in a way, because I really would love to talk to you about the opposite side. You know, when obviously freediving as a sport is largely done in oceans, but as an activity, if we switch the word out for sport, you're engaging with nature in a way that is as close to authentic as it's possible to be when it comes to playing in water. And maybe talk me through, you know, the activity of freediving outside of competition.
Yes, I mean, with freediving, when you take it away from the rope and you take it away from competitions, it's the closest relationship you can have with the ocean. You are, and with yourself to an extent, because you're going back into the water, back in our human history, and back to the roots of where we all come from, right? I mean, we all have this one very, very specific thing in common, that we come from water. That we spend our first 9 months in water, that our first sounds we hear are muffled by water, and that colors are muffled and sight is muffled. And then we're born, and then there's sight and breath and sound, and then it becomes unique, where you are born, it sounds different, looks different, smells different to where I was born. But our first 9 months, we are equal. We are from the same. And I think that's something really beautiful of where we all come from, that we all come from water, and that we all have this adaptation in our body that when we step back into the water, our bodies remember the water. And that's what, in a way, I guess we have modern freediving to thank, to understand something we've always known, that we are water beings and that our bodies actually have this adaptation that's the same as whales and dolphins and seals, the mammalian dive response. And I think freediving is just this beautiful window into a world that many of us yearn for. You know, I think what lies below is the stuff of fairy tales, of psychoanalyses, of everything, right? What lies below. And I think freediving, because it's one breath, it's so accessible, it's also so quiet, and the ocean accepts us differently when we're freediving, because the big mammals are freedivers. The big whales take a big breath and go down, and the seals and the dolphins do too. So the ocean knows breath holders, it knows freedivers. We are not new to that space. And I think that's an incredible sense of coming home and community even within the ocean space that freediving gives us.
That's such an amazing way to look at it. I mean, before we go into this more, I think, could you talk us through the mammalian dive response? You know, what does that mean in practice?
Yeah, I'd love to. So the mammalian dive response is this deep, deep, deep adaptation we have for being in water. And it comes from, at some point in our evolution, we have, as a species, have spent time in and underwater. And the first thing that happens that activates our mammalian dive response is when our face touches water, our heart rate slows down. Bradycardia, and it's very marked and it's very specific. You know, your heart can be racing, Matt, getting in underwater, and it will immediately, when your face touches water, just drop to conserve oxygen and to start bringing that quiet and stillness. So that's bradycardia. That's the first one, the slowing down of the heart rate. The second one is vasoconstriction, and that's got more to do with the gas exchange between oxygen and carbon dioxide. So you're breathing in oxygen. 21% of the air we breathe is oxygen. And then all our bodily functions use oxygen, especially the brain. And so the more we think, the more we use oxygen. So if we can slow down our thoughts, we use less oxygen. But when we take that big breath in with oxygen and we dive down or hold our breath, the carbon dioxide, which is the waste product, starts building up in the body. And there's a slew of things that happen as carbon dioxide builds up. And one of these is that the body notices this rising level of carbon dioxide and says, we must conserve what oxygen we have left. So it constricts the vessels in the arms and legs and flushes the blood back to the core, where it's getting oxygenated by the lungs and pumped to the brain, the most important organ to keep alive. So this vasoconstriction is almost like a centralization of assets, bringing the oxygen back to the center to feed the brain. So that's the vasoconstriction element. And then part of the dive response that was really an interesting, I was part of the process of studying this, is the spleen response. And most people have never consciously thought of their spleen. It's kind of like what I like to call a low glory organ, kind of like, sits there and it does its thing, and everybody talks about the kidneys and the liver and the lungs and the brain. But your spleen is part of your endocrine system, and it basically stores and restores oxygen-rich hemoglobin. So coming back to the oxygen you have in your body is being circulated and used. And as these carbon dioxide levels go up and the body goes, aha, she's freediving, let's release our inner reserves, the spleen constricts and releases this oxygen-rich hemoglobin into your bloodstream, which has been redirected to bring it to the brain.
That is mind-blowing.
Isn't it? I mean, I just love telling people about this. Like, I do sessions sometimes with big wave surfers, and I start off with the mammalian dive response, and I say to them, just knowing this, you're better off in the water. When you're being held down, just imagine this little seal inside of you is waking up, and it's not just you alone under a wave. Your body knows. All you have to do is hold your breath and relax, and your body will take care of you. So for me, the mammalian dive response really is like a reminder of who we are and where we come from and the wisdom of our body, that it's not all. Even though we say freediving is such a mental sport, it's like when we start with a physical and really mentally trust and understand the physical, then we can also create great freedom in that. And I think, you know, there's another part of the dive response that, you know, I don't always talk about in limited time, but I think you would find really interesting. In The Big Blue, if you would remember, they said to the divers, you can't go deeper than 50 or 60 meters because you will die. And now, of course, we know, you know, Herbert Nitsch, the Austrian freediver, has been to over 200 meters. And, you know, guys are and women are diving to over 100 regularly. So physiologically, why they believed 50, 60 would be death is because of pressure on air underwater, that your lungs would get so compressed as you go down that they would basically implode because of the pressure. So any body of gas underwater gets compressed according to the atmospheres as you go down. It's very geeky, and I can figure out from your lung volume at which point you'll be at residual volume, and below residual volume, they thought you would die. What actually happens is as the air in your lungs gets compressed as you go down, a blood shift happens where blood plasma shifts into the capillaries of the alveoli of your lungs to actually cushion and protect the space, the thoracic space, so you don't get crushed by the pressure of the ocean. And this is done through a lot of training and humble progression where you get deeper and your body practices this blood shift that you can actually go deeper because now your lungs are protected by this cushioning of liquid. Because once you get to 50, 60, 70 meters, there's no more air in your thoracic cavity, but you've obviously not imploded. So something has happened there. And this is the blood shift. So this is like the final and very physiologically unique thing that happens in a deep dive. I mean, we are yet to understand what happens in the body of a sperm whale who's an air breather with gigantic lungs that dives down to 3 kilometers, 3,000 meters. Can you imagine the blood shift that needs to happen to protect the lungs and the body of a sperm whale? Our bodies are pretty amazing. And when it comes to mammals in the ocean, we're not the deepest, but we sure are keen.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
But that, I'm fascinated by that as a concept. So obviously, if you look at evolution, we come from water, as you've established and as we all know. But it sounds like as we've evolved, we haven't lost this. And these abilities are not an accident that just, you know, it's like causality, you know, it doesn't necessarily correlation or whatever. Like, it's not something else that we've developed on land that means we're able to do this. It's an actual physical thing that we have based in evolution that has remained in our bodies.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
That's wild.
We're aquatic beings, you know, and when you start digging deeper in the studies that's been done on the aquatic ape theory and others, you know, that really goes very deep into our evolution and starting to really look at how we've spent time near water. And here in South Africa, you know, where we have a lot of the, you know, early mankind, there's caves along our coastline. I mean, I can see some of them right here from my window, where very, very early peoples, they find middens of shells, and, you know, where people were harvesting from the ocean and harvesting deeper than the shoreline to spend time underwater and live off the ocean. It's an incredible source of nutrition, and much easier to catch, you know, some seaweeds and limpets and others than an antelope that you had to run down. So I do think that freediving is kind of a, you know, again, if you're the kind of person who approaches it with, I touched on earlier, like a spiritual aspect more than mental, emotional, and physical, I think it really, you feel that bridge to where we come from, and just being the human experience per se. You know, I think we've become so technological that we've divorced ourselves from the human experience on some kind of deep physical level. And I think freediving is a really, really beautiful link back to that.
Yeah, totally. And I'm interested in the word spiritual. So I'm very interested in it generally as a daily thing, but we're not talking about religion, obviously. What do you mean in this context by spiritual?
I think it's the knowing and experiencing of ourselves being part of something greater and connected to something greater. And that for me has always been nature, and being underwater in the ocean is the most ultimate experience of that. Me in that stillness. You know, we sometimes even speak about the kelp forest, you know, when the light filters through the fronds and there's this like shafts of light coming through, and the way the light refracts and being down there and the colors and the stillness and this light coming through, it's, you know, it's the original cathedral. We never needed to build them, right? We just needed to go into the forests, whether they be on land or underwater or the mountains. So it's definitely for me a place where I find myself connecting with what is much greater than myself.
Totally. Again, a wonderful way to put it. And then, you know, in your introduction, you described yourself as a conservationist. So I don't think it would take a genius to work out maybe where that side of you has come from. But so how have these experiences in the natural world underwater affected the way you view the world and how we treat it and where it's going?
I think I'm an interesting mix where I love people and I love nature. I think a lot of conservationists draw a hard line of the planet would be a better place without people, undoubtedly. But that's not the planet we live on. And it's not the reality we live on. And it's definitely not the gracious and merciful way of looking at the future either, to just wish people away. And I think growing up in South Africa, with the kind of parents I did and the childhood I did, from a very early age, I understood, well, tried to understand, but experienced the world as a social political world, not just a world of homogenous humanity living in nature, but really, like, I grew up during the apartheid time and my parents took a hard stance against that. And so there was much of an awareness of humanity as much as there was of nature. And in my 20s, what I studied in Sweden and worked on in my 20s while freediving was my hobby, was social political filmmaking. So doing documentaries around in Africa and for Swedish news and other channels, really trying to tell stories that show Africa in a different light. That was always my passion. And so where freediving was kind of where I found my own self-expression and peace and the kind of healing from everything I did with people and on land, these things for me were always very closely connected. And knowing what the ocean does for me with connecting to myself and others and peace and healing, I think the more I saw what disconnect from nature does to people and what disconnect from nature allows people to do to nature, became a strong driving force in, I think, what today would be my vision of conservation, is really to connect and in some places reconnect people with nature, with the ocean in particular, and try and see how healthy oceans can help support healthy, well humans and the other way around, and how we need each other. So what that means in practice is that coming back to South Africa after living in Sweden and really working a lot abroad and competing abroad, I started I Am Water, an ocean conservation initiative that works to connect children from underserved communities, so children who live particularly in the townships and don't have a lot of access to nature and have very little access to the ocean. In South Africa, natural spaces have always been very divided, right? I mean, beaches were white only. So if we're speaking about transgenerational fears, it's not hard to understand why there's fear of the ocean and why many South Africans don't swim. So I'm Water, we work with giving children just a beautiful transformative experience in the ocean. And our programs are evidence-based, and we put a lot of work into unraveling how ocean connection works and what you have to offer somebody to create ocean connection, and how from that to ensure behavior change that brings about conservation-mindedness, and how the space of conservation is one for everyone. It has been a very, very narrow field of people who've been allowed to play in the conservation arena. And I think that's one of the reasons we have the problems we have today. So with I Am Water, we try to touch on a lot of those. So I think my vision of conservation is for people to love nature and through all their behaviors act in a way to do no harm and to protect and to help actually further the well-being of natural spaces. And the wonderful thing is it works. I've seen that through the expeditions we've run for paying clients. So whether you're taking some wealthy executive who wants to have a new experience and slowly open their heart and show them the beauty of the wild world and how they in their actions can protect it, to a young 11-year-old who never thought the ocean would be a place for them because they can't swim and because their parents are afraid of it and their community has never been invited into the ocean. So I think behavior change and conservation have to be linked. And I think that comes from loving nature.
I couldn't agree anymore. I think it's that circle, isn't it? Of, you know, there's no negatives to it, like engaging with the natural. I mean, we're preaching to the choir with the audience here probably as well, but like engaging with nature will ultimately turn you into a conservationist in one way or another, even if it's just a minor degree, which is good and fine and should be encouraged. It'll also make you a happier, healthier, better person. But I think this speaks to so much, and you know you've hinted at, you know, children who have a profound lack of access to nature in lots of ways, like true nature. And I think that's true in so many places around the world where actually, we don't have access to these places, whether that's due to, you know, it being privately owned, or whether that's because of wealth gaps. And actually, you know, it's quite expensive to get on a train to go to the beach. It's easy when you're middle class to say, well, just go for a walk. Like, well, where should I do that? And I think that's the, you know, this gets into big world solving conversation. But like, how do we actually engage those outside our echo chambers, which is exactly what you're doing, at like child level, which is a great place to start, right? You know, let's cement it soon. That's the problem I think we all face, because we feel so hopeless so much of the time, so many of us. But actually just getting involved in like conservation in one way or another is an amazing way to feel like you're doing something positive amongst what feels like a broken world sometimes.
Yeah, and even just getting out into nature, you know, I think there's so much that happens in our devices where we think we're living our life, and we so aware, like, you know, we keep, if we engage with some conservation stories, the algorithm will keep feeding you the next one and the next one and the challenges. The next thing you think, the whole ocean is just covered in plastic and all the coral reefs are dead and all the whales have been caught and eaten and, you know, all the sharks' fins are off. And, you know, the reality is that there's still so much left to protect. There's so much beauty. There's so many like-minded people, you know, working for that. And I think just getting into nature, and I think the same goes for terrestrial spaces. And not every nature experience has to be epic. I think that's another misconception. You know, it's like really finding your natural space close to you that you can get to know, and the little critters that live in it and what that looks like. And if you have the opportunity to go into a wilder space, that's wonderful. But I think there's a little bit of being a little bit of elitism around what nature should look like.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that again is a huge conversation, but I think it's also its mindset, isn't it? Because I'm fortunate in some ways because I've had so many positive experiences around the world. You know, my carbon footprint is horrendous and I'm deeply ashamed of it in a lot of ways. But, you know, I notice seasonal changes in city parks as easily as I do in odd growth forest in Canada. And that's because of my exposure, which I recognize my privilege. You know, that's not an accident that my brain works like that now. It's because of my exposure. And we can recreate that without us needing to go on multiple expeditions a year.
Exactly. I think it's so often, you know, finding those accessible experiences for children and instilling that kind of knowledge. Because I also think, you know, previous generations didn't realize how lucky they were with the amount of wild spaces that were around. You know, I think today we need to be more deliberate with how we introduce nature to children. You know, I think it's just a more thoughtful process, and it can be done. And children are naturally curious and naturally want to connect with the natural world. We just need to do that at a time before they get sucked into the technological world, which has a right to exist, but it definitely hasn't got a right to become the world we live in.
Yeah. And the thing, again, these things, you know, I often get frustrated by these like polarities, and it's like, you can simultaneously raise an adventurous wild child who also watches Disney films. Like, this is a thing. It's not very, you know, it's not a complicated concept. Particularly, like, I think children are naturally drawn to water as well, aren't they? I mean, any parents listening, I'm sure, I mean, the amount of times there are waders that live in my car now because we can't go for a walk without it involving a waist-deep puddle. And every time we go for a beach walk in the winter on the east coast of England, my three-year-old now wants to go swimming. And I'm
yeah.
Like, we can't today, and I'm really sorry. And I think, should I say no? Like, is this bad? Is this damaging? But we really shouldn't go swimming today.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. There's child safeguarding and then there's adventure. But they are naturally drawn to water. They're naturally drawn to nature, to picking up a stone and seeing what's under it, to holding a bug. And, you know, I think those things, we can nurture those. And there's enough nature out there and enough left to protect and to work with that I definitely don't have a sense of hopelessness. I have a sense of urgency, but not of hopelessness. And I think that's important because hopelessness is inactive and inactivates people. Whereas if there's motivation towards doing something, I think that's a much better place to be in. And the days when I start feeling overwhelmed by the work and what needs to be done, I have to get in the ocean. It's the only way I can reset that, or into nature if I'm not near the ocean. Like, I have to get into nature. Otherwise, I can't solve these problems behind my computer. Eventually, at some point, I'm going to have action there, but I have to get into nature to connect with solutions.
Isn't that fascinating, though? Because, you know, I know we're kind of playing the philosophy game today a bit, but I find that, like, personally, you know, again, I'm going to be really honest. So I've kind of struggled a bit with my mental health over the last 6 months. And I think that's partly, you know, my wife working a lot, doing a lot of solo parenting, working hard, having some work issues and spending a lot of time sat at a computer or standing at a computer. I went for a run yesterday and I've been really ill, so I haven't been able to run. And it just changed everything. I was happier, honestly. And it sounds really cliche and cheesy, but my mental state completely changed. But why is that happening? You know, I don't actually necessarily understand the answer. What is really going on there?
Yeah, I think, you know, we forget how, as people, everything is connected to everything else, right? And somebody would probably tell you, oh, but Matt, you know, it's endorphins. You just needed to release some endorphins. And it's like, yeah, but it's not just that. You know, a glass of wine can also make me feel quite, like, you know, happy. It's not that. It's yeah. And I think behavioral psychologists have been studying, like, what happens to us when we're outside, when we're breathing air outside, when we're moving our body, when we're connected. And I think it does again, come back to that word spirituality, spiritual, like, because we aren't just our minds, our bodies, you know, we are more than that. And I think it's so easy in our everyday lives to just, you know, and to keep going. And what you were saying about parenting, you know, with your little one being a year old, a friend of mine warned me when I was pregnant with Ethan, our second one. She said, the first year of your second child will be the hardest year of your life. You have to be ready for that. And I was like, whatever, you know, sure. It was the hardest year of my life. And we're just literally starting to lift our gazes and say, oh my God, we survived that. And
we're
again,
identical places right now with that. When I was just telling you, yeah, it's hard.
It's so hard. It's so, so, so hard. And, you know, one day we'll launch a podcast together about parenthood and some children. But I think, you know, the problem as well is when you know these things about yourself, that it's time in nature, it's time doing adventures that bring great joy and great connection. When you are unable to do that with the frequency and the absorption that one used to, like I used to be in the ocean every day, surfing or diving or whatever. And then as a parent, you know, you're doing the things that need to be done. And so you just feel that on such a deep level. And I think we know what it is we need, even though we can't have it. I really feel so much empathy for so many parts of humanity who haven't had that nature experience, for some ever, but for some in a very long time, right?
Yeah. And I mean, there's so much we could say on all of this, but I think a lot of it comes down to like, well, and I really want to do some disclaimers with this sentence, but like ultimately it's all a choice. Like we could all decide, not everybody, you know, there's economic issues to consider, but like we could all move closer to nature if we wanted to. We're making life choices based on priorities that mean we don't. So, and by nature, I don't mean the wilderness in Baffin Island, you know, like we could just get a little bit closer to some trees or the ocean, but we don't. So how do we create those, you know, kind of rhetorical question, I guess, like how do we create those spaces for ourselves to go and do that stuff? Well, it's prioritizing it, understanding the benefit to head, health, the lot. And, you know, I notice it in so many different ways, like me going for a run, which feels like a selfish or self-indulgent act, makes me a better husband and father. Like my wife's like, will you just go for a run?
Totally.
Go away. Go and do it.
Totally. No, Peter's the same for me. You know, I'll get an invitation. I'll be like, oh, you know, this friend asked me if I wanted to go for a surf tomorrow morning, 7:30. But that means you would have to, he's like, just go surf, because, you know, you'll come back like a much better person. So I think so. And I think, you know, these choices, those of us who have choices, are privileged enough to have choices, need to take responsibility and make the right choices, straight up and down. If you're privileged enough to have choices, then, and if that choice means that you're spending time in nature because it makes you a better person, partner, parent, whatever, or the choice to create access for others who don't have choices to be in nature and to experience that in a way, you know, and whether that's just like kids in the neighborhood or organizations who work with that, if you have, you know, less time, more money, you can donate. If you have more time, less money, there's something you can do with that as well, right? And if you absolutely are somebody who doesn't have any choices, then I think, you know, reaching out to organizations and people who are working within that. You know, we get that at iWater too. We have schools reaching out. We have other organizations reaching out saying, you know, what you're doing, we'd like to do as well. And then we always try and find a way to support and to bring that. So I think, yeah, I think we can't assume everybody has choices, but those who do have responsibility.
Yeah. And again, it's kind of a bit, not necessarily obvious, but a bit cheesy or cliche, but I had a lady email me really early on in this podcast's life, like we're talking 4 years ago or something. And she said, it was almost verbatim. She said, I don't have the money to do what you and your guests do. But she said, listening to the episodes has inspired me to change the way I spend time outdoors. And she said, I used to take my 2-year-old to the park, leave them on the play park and sit on my phone. Now we go to the play park, but we climb trees and we look at leaves. And I'm like, I think it's a really interesting point around you actually haven't changed where you're going or the time involved. You've changed how you're experiencing that environment. And that can be enough, I think.
Absolutely.
You know, not listening to, you know, electronic music while I'm running and instead leaving my phone in the car, because nobody really cares how fast I ran that 5K. You know, it's not as important to everybody as I used to think it was, is quite powerful.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's exactly it. And I think, you know, that lady who emailed you, her children will have a different view of the natural world through how she engages with it, whether she's looking at her phone or climbing trees with them, right? Because that shapes how they see the world. Children climb trees, adults look at phones.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want my children to become adults who look at phones. I want them to be adults who dive and climb trees and surf and sail and, you know, get out in nature. And I think that we can model that, whether we're parents or whether we are community members, where we can model that. There's always an opportunity to, yeah, bring that nature-loving ethos to others.
Yeah. No, it's been brilliant talking to you, actually, because this is one of those conversations that I've enjoyed having, but also I sort of needed to have, because, you know, I am not pretending I'm a perfect parent here. Like, I sit on my phone when my children are around sometimes. Sometimes I do it through habit because I am addicted to it. And I don't realize I'm doing it, and I catch myself and I go, oh, shit, stop doing that.
Mm.
Sometimes I have stuff to do, whether that's, you know, booking in something to do with them or doing a bit of work, and it's just making the time to put it down, or maybe even just leaving the room to do it rather than them seeing us with these black mirrors in our faces all the time.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
No, it is. It's such a journey, like figuring out where we best spend our time and how we best show up for our communities, for ourselves, for our children. You know, I think part of our torture that Peter and I have inflicted upon ourselves is within the second year of our two-child family, we also launched a brand, which is insane. But it felt like such a natural progression of what we wanted to do and how we wanted people to connect with the ocean. You know, and I think for me, that dive I did in Sweden where I went down to 19 meters and sat on that ledge and the mask didn't fit, I bought a mask straight after. That mask probably still exists somewhere in the world. How scary, because these things end up in landfill. And so speaking about choices, you know, I think for us, it just became very clear that we wanted to be involved in an entrepreneurial space and in a gear space. And so we've launched a sustainable freediving brand and ocean exploration brand, and we're paying the price for it, right? But our kids are seeing us work with passion and work hard and bring something into the world that we believe in. And so I think, you know, for those who listen who think, well, not all of us can work in nonprofits, not all of us live in a city like Cape Town to do that kind of thing. It's like, you know, you kind of find, for me, my true north is how do I connect people to the ocean in a holistic and well-being way? And whether that's through me teaching freediving, through I Am Water, or now through using Agalis equipment that's better for the environment. If people can get in the ocean and they can do it in a way that's good for them, each other, and the planet, then that's my true north.
Yeah. No, I totally buy it. And I've said this, or other people have said this on this podcast before, maybe once or twice, but, you know, I'm really aware of, like, you and I have got really privileged lives. We've had amazing careers. We've done amazing things. And sometimes I get emails from people who are like, I listened to that and it really helped me because I feel trapped as a parent and things like this. Somebody said to me, which I love, is like, one of the easiest things you can do if you're a parent to help the planet is raise an environmentalist. And I was like, oh my God, that's so true and so good. Because again, it's just that lady putting her phone down and turning the leaves over with the kids. It's like, well, that is actually enough. Like, we've put these people on this planet and it's kind of a pyramid scheme. Like, if they're really good people and they raise good people, that's probably one of the biggest contributions you can actually possibly make.
Absolutely.
That's really powerful.
Yeah, absolutely. And it demands of us to be very deliberate and very present. And like you say, safeguard our own mental health and our own well-being, whatever that may look like.
Yeah. There's that other cheesy line, you've got to put your own oxygen mask on before you help others.
Yep. Because I can tell you all about what happens when you're low on oxygen.
Yeah. Well, so can I, but I'm usually at 1.5 meters. although you're implying I'm not actually low on oxygen.
Exactly. It's all in your mind, Matt. Well, we'll have to go freediving together sometime so I can welcome you down to 10 meters in a calm way.
I would love that. Yeah. Well, you know, we're sort of low on time, but I always ask the same two questions at the end of every episode. And the first is, what scares you?
I mean, I want to say something about conflict in the world and what's happening to children right now as we speak in conflict places. That scares me. It really scares me that we can do that to each other. On another level, one of the reasons I got into conservation when I was freediving competitively was when I had some wild dolphins playing with me and circling. And I really, really, really want my kids to live in a world where wild dolphins will circle them one day, where we have wild places left. It scares me to think of a world without big wild animals playing with us.
And what brings you hope?
Wild dolphins circling me.
I thought that might be coming.
No, I think, yeah, I mean, I do think that the resilience of the ocean, just being able to see how things are interconnected in a strong way as well. We so often speak about, you know, like how that web is fragile because it's all connected, but there's also such strength in it. So that does bring me hope. And I think also seeing what happens to people when they open their eyes underwater and experience the ocean. It's remarkable. It's instantaneous.
Incredible. Thank you. We'll leave it there.
Perfect. Thanks, Matt. It was great to chat.
Thanks for listening. If you want to get in touch, then you can email me at matt@terraincognita.studio. And finally, as always, please do leave us an honest review on iTunes. They're a big help, and it really does help us bring the podcast to a wider audience.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.